This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to begin our show with Sharea Robinson. She is a coordinator with Valley City Green Dot, and she joins us to talk about domestic violence and intervention. Sharea, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What is Green Dot?
Yeah, so Green Dot is a violence prevention program based on, well, to start, I'll have you kind of imagine a map of your community or your neighborhood. And every time a moment of harm occurs, every time someone uses their words or actions to hurt someone else, a red dot on that map appears. And the more times that a red dot appears, people think that it's okay for those red dots to be there, or they think they're inevitable. And so what Green Dot's idea is instead of allowing those red dots to be there, every time a red dot occurs, every time someone uses their words or actions to harm someone else, we respond with a green dot, right? So we may directly intervene if we see a couple arguing and just check in on someone. We may let the bartender know that we saw someone kind of acting strange around someone else's drink and ask them to step in for us. Or if we see a couple fighting outside, we may distract and hit the panic button on our car so that the alarm goes off and we de-escalate that situation. And that way, the more green dots that fill up that map, the less space there is for the red dots to appear. And we can do those green dots either reactively, right, by seeing those red dots, or we can be proactive about those green dots. So like right now where I'm telling you about what Green Dot is, that is an example of a proactive green dot. Or sharing a Facebook post about Domestic Violence Awareness Month is a proactive green dot. And that way we can fill our map of our community with as many green dots as possible so that there's less space for those red dots to appear. And that way we create a new norm that says that violence isn't tolerated in our space and that everyone, each of us, has a role to play in preventing that violence in our space. So what we do in our community, so this is a community-based program, and so in Valley City, we get to know local organizations, local companies, and we work with them and provide trainings to empower people to practice those skills of directly intervening or distracting or delegating to ask for help when they witness red dot behaviors, and give them a chance to practice those and empower them. And that way we can create a safer space here in Valley City.
Why did you get involved?
I know too many people, too many of my friends who have experienced some kind of interpersonal violence, whether that was sexual assault or domestic violence or child abuse or stalking. And for me to know, be introduced to this program and to know that I, as a bystander, I, as someone who knew these people, could help with little small decisions that I make every day, could help and violence meant the world to me to know that I could be empowered to make a difference with a problem that seems huge, you know, so overwhelming.
Well, how did it get started in Valley City?
So the North Dakota Department of Health received a grant from the CDC to address rape prevention and education. And so the North Dakota Department of Health was looking for a strategy that we could implement across the state to help empower people to prevent violence where they are. And so the State Department of Health chose to go with this green dot strategy from Altruistic, and it has been implemented. There's several communities throughout the state. Valley City is one, Grand Forks, Fargo, and Bismarck Mandan are others that are implementing this at the community level to help create safer communities where we are.
October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. That's coincidental to this. There's been speculation about how sheltering in place for the pandemic may have affected domestic violence. Are you aware of any evidence of this?
Yes. So historically, anytime there are natural disasters or major crises, stress levels, isolation, economic anxiety increase, and those are all triggers for domestic violence, people experiencing interpersonal violence. In Valley City alone, the Abused Persons Outreach Center, which is our local crisis center, has seen a 20% increase in the people that they've served since this time last year. In other places like King County and Washington, they saw their rates of murder or death from domestic violence quadruple by this time this year or last time this year. So it's clear that in times like this pandemic, with the stress, with economic anxiety, with the lack of resources, maybe not feeling like you can get out, and with isolation, instances of domestic violence do increase.
Well, a lot of domestic violence happens in the home away from witnesses. How can bystanders make a difference given that reality?
Yeah, and that's something that we definitely struggle with too with Valley City Green Dot, because a lot of our programming is about engaging with people and meeting people and being relational. And so it can be hard to know how to help folks who are experiencing domestic violence where you're not necessarily seeing the same warning signs you would see otherwise. The number one kind of go-to tip for me is to check in with people. If you are worried about a friend, just reach out and ask how they're doing. That's the kind of the easiest thing for me to recommend to folks. Other things that folks can do is to, even just on social media or in their background on Zoom meetings, you could have posters that say that you are a safe place or all are welcome here. Or in your email signature, you could have the phone number for the National Domestic Violence Hotline. And that signals to people that you care about this and that they are not alone. The National Domestic Violence Hotline number is 1-800-799-7233.
Green Dot offers education in bystander intervention. Could you give us an overview of what that entails?
Yeah, so we have two, generally, we have two levels of training. Right now, it's kind of being formed into a virtual training, but generally, we have what we call an overview session. And this is an hour where we kind of share some of the ideas of Green Dot, and you get some practice with it. But then we also have bystander trainings. And these are 5 to 6 hour trainings where you get to dive in and really practice these skills and walk through what are red dots. How do we notice those warning signs? What are ways that we can get involved? How do we stop ourselves generally from getting involved? What are our barriers? And in those trainings, we work through those things and practice kind of implementing those skills so that when folks leave that day, they have already kind of put some of those skills into practice and can work on implementing that outside in their daily life.
Sherea Robinson is the coordinator for Valley City Green Dot. You can find out more about the organization at vcgreendot.com. When is it recommended that people intervene? You offered some ideas when we started this discussion, but what are the indicators that it's time to, you know, do something?
I would say if you are ever worried about someone you know or you witness something that makes you just feel a little unsure, you can always step in. Our goal is that you never feel uncomfortable stepping in your intervention. And that's why we focus on those kind of, the three D's is what we call them. And that's directly intervening, but that's also delegating and distracting. And so that whoever you are, your personality, your personal barriers, if something kind of makes you feel uncomfortable or you're unsure how safe someone is, you can always do something to check in on them or to ask someone else to check in on them or to de-escalate a situation to distract. So you can always intervene at any time in a way that makes sense for who you are and is safe for you to do so.
So you can do that directly as you suggested or earlier, so maybe notify the bartender or, you know, get your car alarm going to distract people or something like that. Isn't someone who intervenes, though, in a sense, increasing their own risk? I mean, this can get difficult. Violence can spread.
Yes. So we really focus on directly intervening when it's safe to do so, right? So if there is if you witness a group of people surrounding one person who's being harmed, it's probably not safe for you to go throw yourself into that unsafe environment. But you can call the police. Right? Or you can let other folks know what's going on so that someone else who may be more equipped to handle the situation can go intervene. If, however, you know of a friend who kind of makes comments about his partner, puts her down or jokes that he has hit her or threatens to hit her, you can tell that friend that his behavior isn't okay. And that's a direct intervention, even though it seems a lot smaller than running into a large fight.
Valley City Green Dot is pretty new. Do you have any success stories that you're aware of in terms of successful interventions?
Yeah, I mean, we launched last July, and then we're working on trainings, and obviously the pandemic has kind of put a hold on a lot of those trainings that we had planned. But what I know from the folks who have gone through the training, in general, a success is that people now know that domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking occur in Valley City, and know that it's a problem. And that's a first step for a lot of folks, because we like to think that we are safe in our small little towns, and that kind of stuff doesn't happen here. And so there's been success in people realizing that this is a problem. And then I also know of some folks who've gone through the training and who have learned that they didn't necessarily have to directly intervene, but they could delegate or they could distract. And they were able to do so. Someone that I know who's very shy and would never directly intervene witnessed an argument and knew one of the people in the argument and called one of their friends and had them go check on them. And so just that little act, them calling someone who they knew to intervene, helped end a moment of violence. And the people going through our trainings are given the opportunity to practice that, go out into the world, make the skills, apply those skills to their everyday moments. And then we also have booster trainings where we send emails or we have little moments where we're able to kind of remind them of what those skills are and ask them how they've been implementing them.
How can people access your training?
Well, in Valley City, we are starting to work on a virtual overview training, and those will be on our calendar, on our website, and on our Facebook page at VC Green Dot on Facebook. So people can find out about those either through the website or Facebook. We'll always have our trainings posted there when we kind of get the date settled down on those.
And you do workplace training eventually when the pandemic eases, or?
Yes. And that was some of the things we had planned that the pandemic kind of put off, was working with local companies here in Valley City to be able to go in to their workplace and train their employees, or having different companies from the same industry kind of send their folks to our trainings on a regular basis until all of their employees have gone through those trainings.
Now, is there a certain level of training that makes you a Green Dot bystander? Do you get a pin, or is there some sort of indication or certificate or whatever?
Yeah, so if you finish the training, we have a bunch of what we call swag that you get at the end of the training that kind of encourages you to go out there and say that you are a Green Dot bystander. But really, you are a Green Dot bystander if you do any of the things that we work through in the training, right? If you start doing proactive and reactive Green Dots, you are a Green Dot bystander.
How is Valley City Green Dot funded?
We are funded through a grant from the CDC mostly. We also have other local donations and gifts from community members that help us run, but we are funded through the CDC by that Rape Prevention Education Grant through the North Dakota Department of Health.
You mentioned Grand Forks and Valley City having Green Dot organizations in Fargo, Moorhead, West Fargo, and Bismarck, Mandan. Are other cities encouraged to start chapters? How difficult is that to do?
The North Dakota Department of Health is the first place to go to kind of find out how a community could start working with Green Dot through them, or implementing Green Dot through the North Dakota Department of Health, since we have those connections with Altruistic, who created the Green Dot program. But there's also education Green Dot programs for K through 12 levels of school and a university or college program of Green Dot. And so either talking with the North Dakota Department of Health or altruistic.org, people can find out more about how they could bring Green Dot to their communities.
Now, is this something that can be integrated through education too? I mean, I assume that kids in school are given some basic understanding of their responsibilities to each other, you know, social interaction and all that. But is there an awareness that really goes through all age groups as to what can be done to help curb violence or to get people more socially involved in their environment and the dangers that other people might face because they don't intervene?
Yeah, so like I said, Green Dot does have a K through 12 education kind of program. And I know that a lot of the school districts throughout the state also have other kind of violence prevention programs that they implement in their schools. So those are always implemented in ways to talk about how kids can look out for, you know, healthy dating relationship cues and things like that about how they can look out for one another. And we never want to make kids responsible for looking out for adults and holding them responsible. But there are programs that help kids look out for each other and help prevent violence that way.
I suppose the goal is that eventually enough people are made aware of this, whether they're Green Dot bystanders or not, that anybody who's thinking of doing anything that would be dangerous or violent or untoward, at least in public, would be, well, perhaps think twice, because they would think, you know, maybe in days past, people might just look away and walk on. But if they don't look away and they don't walk on and they intervene, that means you're in trouble.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's kind of the point of Green Dot, is that if enough of us make those small daily decisions every day that help kind of share that violence isn't tolerated and that we all have our role to play in preventing it, then the whole norm changes where we are in our communities, and people can't just get away with that anymore. And so that is the goal, and the idea is that as soon as we have enough people doing enough green dots, then there's no space for the red dots on the map anymore.
Sherea Robinson is the coordinator for Valley City Green Dot. You can find out more about her organization and get some ideas for perhaps one in your town at vcgreendot.com. They also have a Facebook page, Valley City Green Dot. Sherea, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
More Main Street in a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them, in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Hey, Prairie Public. I'm Jake Threlkill, host of the Magic City's late night show, Good Night Live.
How's everybody doing tonight?
You know it. You love it. And backed by overwhelmingly popular demand, If Businesses Had Tinder. You know, Chicago may have had Second City, but we're proud to be North Dakota's third city comedy troupe.
Jake, we're fourth in population.
Nah. Well, good comedy comes from places that have a chip on its shoulder.
Minot's own Dizzy the Clown was recently installed as the president of the International Shrine Clown Association. Dizzy, if you're looking for a side hustle, Minot's looking for a city manager.
So to make up for that supposed tower work in Minot, Prairie Public is sending Main Street's Ashley Thornburg to be a guest on the show.
I work at a nonprofit, so you can definitely afford me.
Good Night Live, Saturday, October 24th at 6:30 p.m. at the Original Bar and Nightclub in Minot. If you want to see the most serious comedy this side of the Mouse River,
Cirrus,
then join us at the Original. Tickets and information at goodnightlive.com. It's a big show for a small town.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Eliza Blue is a writer and musician who produces audio essays of her life in rural South Dakota. She calls them Postcards from the Prairie. Today's postcard is a lighthearted take on traveling with little ones.
This summer, my kids were 2.5 years and 8 months old, respectively. They've operated pretty consistently as fearless leader and loyal sidekick. Emmy Rose thought everything her big brother did was hilarious, and he was protective and loving towards her. On a road trip in July of that year, both kids spent 2 days strapped in car seats. I stocked the vehicle with an emergency toy bucket, and when they got restless, I would throw a few toys back or tell a story or sing a song. This mostly worked for keeping morale up, but there were a few times when restlessness, particularly for my son, got the better of us. It was during one of these times that he discovered he could make the most horrible sound in the world. Seriously, it was so bad. High-pitched and unyielding, it would leave my ears ringing for miles, result in immediate sobs from the baby, and I am honestly surprised it didn't crack the windshield. Not surprisingly, it took Emmy about 2 seconds to learn the sound. If brother does it, it must be good, so she began merrily screaming her way through all kinds of activities. Lunch, naps, diaper changes. There were no bad times to practice screaming in Emmy's world, which made it very difficult to discipline her brother. Like most toddlers, his sense of justice was strong. His reasoning was not. Explaining to him that she was just a baby and different rules applied fell on, pun intended, deaf ears. Consequently, once one of my beloved children started screaming, the other was quick to join, and in about 2 seconds flat, I was ready to tear out my hair or leave them at the post office with a return to sender label. It reminded me of something that happened to me pre-parenthood. I was talking on the phone with a friend who had two very young children in the back seat. The sound they were making was horrible and completely drowned out everything my friend was saying. I kept asking if she needed to go. "No, it's fine," she said. "They are in a screaming phase. You know how it is." For the record, I didn't. Yet. Suddenly, it got quiet. "Did they fall asleep?" I asked. "No," she said calmly. "I just pulled over, and I am standing outside the car." Every once in a while, for the rest of our chat, she would open the car door and gently ask, "Are you ready to stop shouting?" The response was mayhem, at which point she would shut the car door again and continue our conversation. I was horrified at the time. Couldn't she make her kids behave better than that? Was that really the best she could do? I now know the answer. Yes, yes it was. In fact, her restraint was quite remarkable. I wish I could be as calm as my friend under similar circumstances. It's so easy to judge other people, to think you could do better as a parent or as a friend or as a citizen. But the challenges of life are useful in this regard. I certainly learned a lot about humility from parenting toddlers. 2 years later, my kids don't act as fearless leader and loyal sidekick anymore. They are both fiercely independent and more likely to be screaming at one another than in unison. This means a new set of parenting adventures and new revelations and new opportunities to grow in compassion and empathy. I don't have it all figured out, not even close. But I keep trying to default to love whenever possible, which is all any of us can do. Meanwhile, we had our first snow yesterday, leaving the prairie smooth and clean with the faint spice of autumn. My children ran out to greet it with laughter and open arms. All around us, the hills and folds of the land now hold the brushstrokes of white over gold, a gentle reminder that after drought there will be rain, after heat there will be a cool breeze, and after the screaming there will be, eventually, peace.
In addition to her writing, Eliza tours and performs with fellow songwriter and banjoist Jamie Lynn as the Nesters. To hear her music or find out where she will be performing, visit ElizaBlueMusic.com.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Coming up on Main Street, October is Dyslexia Awareness Month. We'll talk about that with Decoding Dyslexia North Dakota Outreach Coordinator Anna Hoover. And Sue Balcom will drop by for Main Street Eats. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A state mill and elevator in Grand Forks is adding to its milling capacity. It's a $23.5 million project.
We're running hard. Mills are running 24/7.
Mill manager Vance Taylor outlined the plan for the state's Industrial Commission.
Our plan is to purchase and install a new 6,000 hundredweight Durham mill and a new 4,000 hundredweight spring wheat mill in the area that in the G Mill building that we have available. And we would also convert the present Durham mill, which is a 3,000 hundredweight capacity unit, to run spring wheat. And that capacity would increase by 1,000 hundredweights per day.
Taylor says it will increase sales, and that means the mill will be buying more North Dakota wheat.
The project will create an additional demand for 8,300,000 bushels of North Dakota spring wheat in Durham going forward.
Industrial Commission members approve the project, saying it's a win-win for flour sales and for North Dakota farmers. North Dakota's COVID-19 positive percentage continues to rise as more cases are confirmed by the State Health Department. Out of 8,378 tests, 1,038 new cases have been confirmed today for a positive rate of 13.09%. 48 of North Dakota's 53 counties are reporting new cases. There were also 9 more deaths, bringing the state death toll to 431. The patients were from Cass, Grand Forks, Grant, Lemoore, Morton, Richland, and Ward counties. They were in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s and had underlying health conditions. To date, 790,378 tests have been administered and 277,692 unique individuals have been tested. A total of 35,052 people have tested positive since the pandemic began. There are currently 6,350 active confirmed cases, the highest on record so far. And as Halloween approaches, thoughts are also turning to holidays like Thanksgiving and Christmas. AAA North Dakota spokesman Gene LaDucer says experts are already saying the pandemic will continue to shape how we celebrate.
We see people wanting to travel. They're cautiously optimistic that they'll be able to travel, but they're also, you know, taking the necessary precautions. And in many cases, that means staying home or close to home.
LaDucer says following the guidance developed by health officials will be the key for anyone traveling during the holidays. He says with some preparation, travel by air may still be an option. LaDucer says those same precautions should be kept in mind once your actual gathering and celebrations begin.
Yeah, you know, the more more people there are, the greater the risk when it comes to COVID. So, you know, follow the CDC guidelines and see what they say before you're traveling. But, you know, if you take the necessary precautions, you follow that guidance, we feel that you can probably still travel and enjoy the holidays without unnecessary risk.
LaDucer says demand continues to be soft for gas, so he is expecting to see prices at the pump continue to remain low until the early stages of 2021. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Anna Hoover. She is the Outreach Coordinator for Decoding Dyslexia North Dakota. Thanks for joining us, Anna.
Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure.
What is the mission of Decoding Dyslexia North Dakota?
So Decoding Dyslexia is a parent-led national grassroots movement in 50 states and 5 Canadian provinces. So this is a very global effort to bring awareness for dyslexia. Okay, and so this is how we got started. So in January 2019, a group of parents, educators, and community leaders established our Decoding Dyslexia North Dakota, and it was based on the state passed House Bill 1461 with Michelle Strinden of Fargo. So the pilot program allotted $250,000 to cover screening costs for dyslexic children in our state. And each school district had to apply for that. So that's kind of how we got started, kind of based around this bill. And so Decoding Dyslexia North Dakota strives to raise dyslexia awareness, empower families to support their children, improve resources for children with dyslexia.
How would you describe dyslexia to someone who isn't challenged by the condition?
So I myself have dyslexia, and I was diagnosed early. I was 4 years old when I was diagnosed. So I'm originally from Baltimore, and I'm living in Williston, North Dakota, finishing up my teaching license online this semester. So kind of what raised a red flag for my family was, you know, my preschool teacher just said, you know, something's just not right with her. You know, I wasn't getting rhyming words. I wasn't following multi-step directions because I also have ADD. And so that kind of really raised the red flag for my parents, who further pursued the preschool teacher's suggestion in getting me tested. And so what most parents kind of look for is we look for, like, delayed reading, delayed rhyming abilities. It's a speech and language disorder, essentially, what it is. And so anything kind of that relates to that, really, we raise a red flag. And this is according to Amanda Morin and her website. Myth one, reading and writing letters backward is the main sign of dyslexia. That is false. Fact, children commonly reverse letters. It's not unusual to see children confuse a B and a D or write a P instead. If your child is still doing so by the end of first grade, it may be a signal of an education evaluation. And then myth two, dyslexia doesn't show until elementary school. That is false. fact, signs of dyslexia can show up in preschool or even earlier. Because dyslexia can affect language skills that are essential skills for reading and writing. So one sign would be having kids struggling with rhyming words or having speech reversed.
What do we know about what causes it?
What causes dyslexia is it's a neurological disorder. So it's like it's in my brain. It's genetic. And so somebody in my family had dyslexia. We think it's my grandfather and my dad. So it's passed down. But it's a part of our brain that kind of, it's not wired the right way, a different way, yes.
I went online to the website dyslexiaida.org. That's the International Dyslexia Association. And I discovered there that there are different types of dyslexia. How would you describe these different types?
So you can have dyslexia in math, called mathlexia. And dyslexia is a range. It's a spectrum disorder. So you can have dyslexia very mildly with needing very little school support, or you have it very severely. So I had dyslexia very severely. And then I had to go to a school in Baltimore called the Odyssey School for dyslexic children. And there I got intensive reading therapy. I did a lot of Orton-Gillingham reading therapy there. So I went there for 8 years. And like I myself as an adult still struggle with like spelling and math. I always like have to ask somebody like, does this look okay?
When I was going to school, it's a long time ago now, I don't ever remember hearing dyslexia in grade school or in junior high. And that would seem to be a very important thing for teachers to know. Let's talk about the importance of teachers finding this or discovering it and getting students to the proper help.
Right. You know, in our state, we're just starting to have the conversation with our local schools and school districts about using the proper terminology of using the word dyslexia. A lot of them will use the word reading delay or reading impairment, which is, it's fine, but, you know, I kind of like to call it by its medical diagnosis, which is dyslexia. I think teachers just need to be very vigilant and just, you know, make sure they're using phonics-based reading materials for their kids, making sure they're, you know, making sure that kids are learning each letter sound is very important for any kid.
What about the connection? Is there a connection, I guess, between dyslexia and what we refer to as illiteracy?
I mean, I would say that that there is a connection between both. Kind of like that's why we educators, or I myself, and a couple of my folks at Decoding Dyslexia, our president, Justine Gibbons, is really big on using phonics-based learning, and that can really help the kids that are struggling to read and may not have dyslexia. So, like, not every child who can't read will be dyslexic, and that's the tricky part of it. It's trying to figure out, okay, like, how do we accurately find out a good diagnosis?
So, in reality, we might be surrounded by people that are functionally illiterate who might be dealing with something else, dyslexia.
Right, yes. Like I said, I'm not a diagnostician, clinician, or a speech pathologist or a school psychologist, but, you know, there is many other different learning differences you can have that could display some of the same characteristics as dyslexia.
So this increased awareness about dyslexia in October is Dyslexia Awareness Month might make it possible for people who consider themselves functionally illiterate to be evaluated and discovered to be dyslexic and maybe get treatment even at an older age?
Oh, yes, there is. You know, at Haley's Hope in Fargo, their head of the organization that she started, her name is Kari, and she deals with a lot of adults that are dyslexic and struggle in the workplace because their boss may not understand what dyslexia is. I think as an adult, that's kind of another aspect that we need to bring awareness to is, yes, dyslexia does not go away. I have it. I'm 30. It's not going to go away. I learned how to cope with it. But Kari has had a lot of some of her clients come in and being adults and are struggling at work. They're bright. They can do the job, but they just struggle maybe in reading, writing, organization. So, yeah, it's not common for adults to find out later in life they're dyslexic.
You just said some people might be struggling at work. They're bright. So the relationship between dyslexia and intelligence, it doesn't mean you're not smart if you're dyslexic.
No, there's nothing between intellect and, you know, and not being smart with dyslexia. Dyslexia is usually people with average IQs to higher IQs.
And you said you're finishing a teaching certificate. Of course,
Yeah. You
would be teaching with this higher awareness of this disorder, or this condition, because you live with it. Is that
right.
Your goal to do?
Yes. That and work on the lobby side of bringing awareness to our government to hopefully get some more grant money for this kind of disability. Yes, that is.
Is there any estimate of the percentage of people who might be dyslexic along this spectrum from mild to severe?
I don't feel comfortable guessing, so I don't have that information in front of me.
Anna Hoover is the outreach coordinator for Decoding Dyslexia North Dakota. Again, there is a website, dyslexiaida.org, for the International Dyslexia Association. And I know that Decoding Dyslexia North Dakota has a Facebook page as well. Anna, thanks for spending time with us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
Main Street Eats is next.
Darkness falls throughout the land. The midnight hour is close at hand. The Snap Judgment Halloween special returns, Spooked 11, Fire and Fog. Amazing stories from real people who can scarcely believe it themselves. Be afraid. Snap Judgment. Do not miss it.
Saturday at 5 Central, 4 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg. And, of course, it's Thursday. It's time to talk about Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom.
Sue joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm. Sue, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You want to talk about popcorn balls today, something nobody gives out on Halloween anymore.
Oh, and that is a travesty. Did you ever get a popcorn ball?
Not a homemade one.
I think dentists used to hand them out, didn't they?
Yeah.
Because
yes.
I think that's
sometimes
who likes them.
they can pull a filling out, right?
Absolutely. If they're made correctly, they can. But we have to start a popcorn ball, of course, with popcorn, which is definitely a grain. I don't think that we grow popcorn up here in North Dakota for, you know, sale anywhere, but I know they do in Iowa. And I remember as a child reading some kind of crazy book about a family that opened up a squash and they found a buckle, and somehow there was a fire on their farm and there was all this popcorn. They were drowning in popcorn because the field just popped up from the fire. But popcorn has been around for a really long time because it is considered a whole grain and it is kind of healthy for you until it becomes a popcorn ball.
Yeah. Well, the popcorn itself, though, what are the health benefits?
Well, as we all know, we eat a lot of popcorn where I come from. My mom used to make it for us almost every night of the week after supper as a snack, and it's high in fiber. It is low in fat and sugar if you just make popcorn with it. And it does have some vitamins and minerals. It's absolutely cholesterol-free based on the fact that you probably are doing air popping instead of, you know, there's cholesterol probably in whatever oil you select to make popcorn with. And I was the designated popcorn popper at my house. And what we did was, I'm not kidding you, when my folks had company, Sue, go make us some popcorn. And the one time I refused, I paid dearly for it. So we continued to make popcorn then for my parents. And I had this old, my mom had this old pressure cooker. It was heavy as all get out. And the cover was gone, but it had that ridge around the top. And then we just replaced it with a different cover. And I would be in charge of making popcorn. So I am a popcorn connoisseur. I do not like popcorn that comes in a bag that's made in the microwave, because that is like not healthy for you. And it doesn't have the best of all flavors. So this time of the year, we can find Boy Scouts selling popcorn. And that's a pretty high quality popcorn with a pretty high quality price. But Orville Redenbacher, I find, makes probably the best popcorn on the market. And you can get what is called yellow hullless popcorn. The white popcorn has hulls in it when it's popped, and the yellow doesn't. So if you're going to make popcorn balls, you want to definitely get the hullless popcorn from the store.
I've got a little interjection here. There's a pandemic-related popcorn story out there, and that is because movie theaters are closed. This highest grade of popcorn, which they're the people who get it, is out there. And the people who produce popcorn, like all of Indiana, I guess, are desperate to find ways to move this very high-quality popcorn.
Oh my gosh, I would
maybe
take
the
some...
popcorn ball will come back this year.
Yes.
The Christmas trees. Even though... Remember when they were stringing Christmas trees?
Yes. I strung Christmas tree popcorn, and then I would save it from year to year.
Oh my God.
And I wonder if it isn't like styrofoam.
Who does that?
Based...
I'm sorry. Did
I
you
do.
Just what no? Didn't mice oh, eat no. this or
oh, I never even thought of that. I keep it. I've never had the problem, I guess. but my mom made popcorn balls for Halloween. It's just that people don't trust you anymore, and kids don't go trick-or-treating because it's dangerous. And this year it's going to be colder than a you-know-what. Mm. And so the only one out are going to be the witches this Halloween. But I'm still making popcorn balls.
So what's one your of the secret? Things,
one of the things, and here it is, you need to absolutely sift your popcorn. Now you can do it like my mom did, where she would put it in a big old bag and shake it. You're shaking down all the old maids. And then that way you just take the popcorn from the top. But if you make mass quantities, which of course, you know, I'm kind of into that production mode this time of year, you can get a hardware cloth that's got just enough space for those kernels to go through. And you sift that popcorn, sift the bad stuff out of that popcorn with a great big huge, I use a big old storage bin that specifically I use for food items. And that way you don't get so much of that bad stuff in there. You're working with the fluffy kernels instead. And that way it's better for your teeth, as you mentioned.
I have lost a tooth to a granny, that's for
have
sure.
Have you?
No. Yes, I have.
There's a lot of recipes out there, but my old favorite is still the one with the Karo syrup. And that's, you know, Karo syrup, not to be confused with corn syrup, is okay to use for popcorn balls. And it's funny, too, because there's a lot of people who've never made popcorn balls before, and the recipe includes a little baking soda and vinegar. At least my mother's does. And dark or light syrup, I prefer the dark, because it gives a more caramely flavor. And then, of course, a little teeny tiny butter, a little bit of salt, a little bit of vanilla extract, and you are simply boiling sugar and syrup together with butter, of course. And the more butter you put in, the more caramely kind of fattening popcorn you're going to get. This negates the health benefits. Okay, let's get that out there right now.
Well, my mother caramel- was from the South, and she used to... she didn't use the Karo syrup. She used molasses.
Oh, but that would be good. So you've got your popcorn popped and you've got your extra big kettle, because you definitely don't want this syrupy stuff running over your hands or your glass top stove, because sugar is the enemy of glass top stoves. And so you're boiling this until it reaches a gooey stage, and that can be tested by temperature, which I can't recall what the temperature is, but if you have a candy thermometer, it will say soft, hard, soft stage or hard stage on your thermometer. And you want this to be a soft stage syrup, meaning that it's not going to be crunchy. It's going to be chewy instead. But you can test that in a little bit of cold water. Like you drip a little bit of that syrup in there and then you rub it with your hands and you're like, yeah, I think I can manage to bite through that. And then you know it's done. And then you add that. There's a little vinegar in my mom's recipe. And then you add a little bit of baking soda, which kind of breaks that up into this big foamy mass. And that way it coats your popcorn easier. And so you dump that in there. And then you be very careful and make your popcorn balls with cold water at your side. Because the stuff is really hot. And yes, it can burn your little fingers. If they're not like mine, leather. I have leather hands anymore.
I bet.
But my mom's dad actually made her a popcorn ball maker out of two turned wooden cups that fit kind of inside each other, but not all the way. And you scoop up that popcorn and you give it a little twist and drop it into the cookie sheet or whatever. I let mine kind of cool off and dry off a little bit, but you can freeze popcorn balls if they last that long, because they never do at my house. I love popcorn balls. I think it's the chew, you know. But if you want to be on a diet, don't make popcorn balls. But popcorn is just a wonderful thing, and I miss the movie theater popcorn. But I am greatly offended when they say to me, would you like butter on that? And I'm like, do you have butter?
Do you
have
real
butter? Because what they put, yeah, what they put on there is not butter. So we eat ours plain, and we eat big tubs of it when we go to the movies.
Yeah.
I pass on the butter too, but when I'm making it at home, sometimes I am conscious of, you know, the oil or whatever I'm making that with it. And there are these air poppers out there. I some people may not like them, but I don't mind the flavor of air popcorn.
Well, how much butter do you put on it when it's popped?
I'm not a butter popcorn guy. I like it plain.
And that's when it's really good for you. And it is palatable. I mean, it's okay to eat that. And if you're going to make it, we use those stir crazy poppers. Like we have gone through four of those already in my lifetime. Stir crazy popcorn makers are the best. Hmm. And you can make the sugary popcorn that you can get at art fairs in those things and everything. I use coconut oil.
Yeah.
When I'm making popcorn.
Coconut oil. But then I like to drizzle with avocado or walnut or olive oil. And then I do pepper.
Oh, God,
and
I love walnut oil.
Nutritional yeast, actually. That's what I like on my popcorn.
Oh, that's good. A little bit of fresh Parmesan never hurt. Ooh, once, yeah, in a while, right, either.
Mm-hmm.
But coconut oil will definitely make your popcorn less greasy.
Yeah.
My mom told me one time, or was it my grandmother told me one time, they went to someone's house, and when they served popcorn as a snack, because they always lunched before they went home, they were given popcorn in a bowl with a spoon so they could keep their hands from getting greasy.
Oh, wow.
I know, special, right? Now, just on a final note here, don't go out and steal popcorn from the field next to your house, because popcorn is a special variety of corn that you can grow if you wish. I think that Prairie Road Organics actually has a black popcorn seed that you can get from them if you want to try and grow your own. But definitely make a couple popcorn balls for Halloween, don't you think?
Yes.
I'll let you.
Bon appetit. We check in with Sue Velcom every week. It's always a pleasure, Sue.
Oh, thank you, guys.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll talk with the president of the newly formed North Dakota Film Society, Scotty Nolan. He'll talk about the Film Society and how the film and TV industry have been devastated by COVID-19. And we'll also visit the Northwest Angle. That's next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 22nd. Celebrating the 100th year since the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. This series is written and voiced by Sarah Walker.
North Dakota's fourth annual industrial exposition took place in Bismarck in October 1914, and the city was bustling with activity. The Bismarck Tribune proudly exclaimed, "Never in the history of the state was there such an elaborate, extensive, and excellent display of the state's products. Not only is there quantity, but also a quality which is perfection itself, accompanied by beauty unsurpassed." 1914 marked the 25th anniversary of statehood, so a special state and anniversary day was planned for the exposition. Other special days occurred almost every day during the two-week run. On this date, it was Suffragist Day. Voters would soon have the chance to pass suffrage in North Dakota, so this day was called a last united effort before the men of the state go to the polls to decide this great question. The day was preceded by an anti-suffrage day. The anti-suffragists made no plans and held no programs, although they did maintain a booth that offered opposition literature. The suffragists, on the other hand, went all out, making as big a demonstration as possible. They planned speeches and, quote, "a general demonstration of the fact that the women are in town," unquote. They held a suffrage parade in the afternoon headed by the Bismarck Band that featured many businesses and groups. At one point, many school children marched through, all waving yellow pennants bearing the inscription, "Vote for Mother." Local high school girls took up the cause on a variety of floats in a sort of pageant. The first float held the Goddess of Liberty and 11 girls who represented full suffrage states. Next were 7 girls representing the states that had an active campaign leading to an upcoming election. 20 girls representing partial suffrage states followed. Then came 15 girls dressed in black, with drooping heads, representing the states in which no women could vote. After the parade, each of the schoolgirls was to be given a yellow rose. Though the bid for suffrage in 1914 would ultimately be unsuccessful, the suffragists gave it their all, an effort that certainly helped further the cause. This is Sarah Walker.
This series is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota and the North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Bruce Springsteen's new record is about loss and death, themes that make his songs somehow hopeful.
It's just the drinking in of life, you know, the having the experience of having been here.
He reflects on what he's lost and gained after 50 years as a songwriter. Plus, we recap the presidential debate on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show right there at prairiepublic.org. Friday on our show, if you have kids at home looking for adventure, they might want to check out Duluth author Margie Preuss. On our show tomorrow, the New York Times bestselling author visits with Ashley Thornburg about a new mystery she's written, The Silver Box. News director Dave Thompson will have his Friday review of the week's big stories, and Matt Olean will review The Kid Detective. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.